Donald Trump has been busy. In the past couple of days, he's switched sides in the war in Ukraine, announced a national crypto reserve, and dismantled the National Weather Service, because part of the fun of experiencing a Category 5 hurricane is the surprise.
Surprise! Well, it's not a hurricane, but we got a lot of surprises.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am... From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other excellent affiliate stations on both the airwaves, the public airwaves, and the internets around the country and the world. Blanketing planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. All right, we have got a guest that I am quite eager to speak to standing by. Coming up in a bit, a story that I'm quite eager to talk about, to tell you about, a sort of out of the blue, and I think that's the right phrase for it here, Desi Doyen.
Yes, I think it is.
A sort of out of the blue redistricting measure by Democrats in a purple state, in fact. One that has a Republican governor right now, a very surprising move on several levels, but a potentially very good news move for those hoping that Democrats will increase their pushback against Donald Trump and the Republicans' gerrymandering wars as the Republicans try to steal a majority in the U.S. House next year that they seem to be admitting they are otherwise unable to win on their own due to their terrible, unpopular policies with the American people. So if you've yet to hear about this story just breaking, you'll want to stick around for that, if nothing else. Also a bit later, Desi Doyen and our latest Green News Report.
Yeah, stick around for that.
And
for
yeah,
sure.
Why wouldn't you want to stick around for that?
Always fun.
But first, speaking of the Green News Report, longtime listeners will recognize that the GNR has for, well, nearly two decades now, frequently reported on critical climate data produced and/or collected by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. The federal agency, among other things, studies and regulates marine ecosystems and sustainable fishing. It also monitors weather systems via the National Weather Service, which is housed at NOAA, which is itself part of the Department of Commerce, where the agency plays a critical role in disaster preparedness, environmental protection, scientific research, and yes, understanding of, preparation for, and mitigation of our quickly worsening climate crisis. Or at least it did, until the Trump administration, on behalf of its friends in the dirty, deadly fossil fuel industry, began its seemingly unstoppable efforts at undermining climate change research by gutting critical climate science programs and laying off more than 1,000 scientists and other staffers, some 20% of its workforce, over the past 9 months since Donald Trump returned to office. Along with those mass firings and defunding of critical scientific programs and databases at NOAA, the public has lost access to critical data, relied upon by a broad range of sectors across both the U.S. and world economy. The timing for this dangerously ill-considered backslide and gutting of climate science and data could hardly be worse. As NBC News reported on Wednesday, for example, the first half of 2025 was the costliest ever recorded for weather and climate disasters in the United States. That, according to an analysis published Wednesday by the nonprofit organization Climate Central. That is information that the public might never have learned, NBC notes, because earlier in the year, the Trump administration cut the program at NOAA that had tracked weather and climate-related events that caused at least $1 billion in damage. The researcher who led that work, Adam Smith, left NOAA over that decision. The billion-dollar weather and climate disasters database, which the Trump administration, quote, retired back in May, has now thankfully officially relaunched outside of the government using the same methodology thanks to Climate Central, the nonprofit research group focused on the effects of climate change, and which hired Smith to redevelop the database using the same methodology and including NOAA records going back to 1980. In its first update at the new site this week, the database shows that the first 6 months of 2025 have been the most expensive first 6 months of any year since 1980, when NOAA began tracking this data point. The billion-dollar database tracks the financial costs of property and other infrastructure destroyed by extreme weather disasters in the U.S., focusing on those events that cost $1 billion or more in damage as adjusted for inflation. So far, 2025 has racked up more than $100 billion in such losses. According to the organization's new analysis, 14 weather events exceeded $1 billion each in damages in the first 6 months of the year. The January wildfires in Los Angeles out here were by far the most expensive natural disasters so far this year. They cost more than $60 billion in damage. That also makes them the most expensive wildfire event on record, by the way. The findings from the database show how the costs of weather and climate disasters continue to escalate. Yes, even as Donald Trump continues to call climate change a, quote, con job, while cutting hundreds of billions of dollars meant to mitigate and or reverse its deadly effects. According to the latest update of the database this week, as of June 2025, based on records, again, back to 1980 when the data set kept by NOAA and now Climate Central began, there have been 417 U.S. weather and climate disasters in total, with overall damages exceeding $1 billion, with a total cost exceeding $3.1 trillion. Now, imagine if we had spent anywhere close to that number to actually help prevent such disasters in the first place, rather than, for example, subsidizing behavior by the fossil fuel industry that simply makes these disasters worse and more costly and, of course, more deadly. Between 1980 and 2024, there were 9 such billion-dollar disasters on average each year. However, in the past 5 years, that annual average has jumped to 24 such disasters each year, with the record for a single year being, so far, 28 events back in 2023. All of that information is, of course, fascinating, but it's also important for a whole bunch of reasons. Here to discuss just some of those important reasons and why all of this data is now being tracked by a private organization rather than the U.S. government is Tom DiLiberto, a meteorologist, climate scientist, and award-winning science communicator at the nonprofit Climate Central, where he serves as media director. Prior to that, Tom worked as a public affairs specialist in the Office of Communications at NOAA, where he was laid off by the Trump administration back in March as part of its gutting of climate science-related offices and personnel. He served as the senior climate scientist for NOAA's climate.gov site that published information about changing weather patterns, drought conditions, agricultural best practices, atmospheric changes, and greenhouse gas emissions, a critical tool used by farmers, businesses, and the public alike as one of the many critical taxpayer-funded science data websites that have now been shut down by the Trump administration. Oh, Tom DiLiberto, welcome to the broadcast, sir. Delighted to have you here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So I do want to talk about your own, your personal experience at NOAA and what you observed from the inside as the administration has begun to tear it down. Focusing on the billion-dollar weather and climate disaster database for the moment, as mentioned, we've long relied on that data from NOAA on our syndicated Green News Report, sort of a gauge for how the U.S. and global nations fight against climate change and global warming. and how that fight is, or as the case may be, isn't proceeding. It's a fascinating reference point, but it's also an important tool for several broad sectors of the economy itself. Can you sort of speak about why the database is actually important in that sense, how it is used by various companies and state and local officials, et cetera?
Yeah, sure. The amount of information it's that goes into creating this billion-dollar disaster analysis, it's a lot. And for a long time, the one place that could manage to do all of that was a government agency like NOAA. It was much too difficult for an individual company to be able to do this, although there are folks who do this, other insurance companies that do this, but that data ends up being proprietary. So while they do it, they don't tell people necessarily about it, unlike the billion-dollar disaster data set, which was freely available when it came out of NOAA, which meant that you didn't have to be an insurance company. You could be a decision maker. You could be deciding with your local community what you need to do to help deal with these increasing costs. You could be starting your own company. You could all of this, and you would be able to get this freely available information. And it's one of the reasons why that when this data set did disappear, the demand for it never stopped. In fact, people were eagerly and hoping for the revival of this data set. And that came from all aspects of society, the private sector, academia, local communities, decision makers. And it's something that for a long time was a jewel of the global economic group of people who looked at this, because the United States had this. This is not something that's really, really hard. And the U.S. had this, and other countries looked to it as a model for what they wish they could do back in their own countries.
Scientifically speaking, I guess, what is your broad takeaway of what we've learned this week with the latest update, actually the first update to the database? Thank you, Climate Central. What's sort of your broad takeaway from this new update of this data?
I guess scientifically, I'd say, geez, it's a lot of money. It's a lot of disasters. It's just a continuation of what we've seen the last 3, 4, 5 years. You mentioned that 2023 had the most billion-dollar disasters on record in, of 28. Last year had the second most billion-dollar disasters at 27. So we've had 55 separate billion-dollar disasters in just, you know, the two previous years. And then the first half of 2025 already is above the 30-year average. We've already had 14 separate events, including the LA wildfires, which didn't just destroy the previous record for the most costly wildfire. It wasn't even in the same world as it, more than double the previous record. And the interesting thing is, like, when we think about billion-dollar disasters, you're often thinking about, like, wildfires or hurricanes. But the other 13 events that happened all revolved around severe weather. Hail, tornadoes, and flooding happening all across the central and eastern United States over the first half of the year, which just goes to show that when we talk about this, there's no place across the country that can avoid these potential disasters, which is why it's so important that this information is freely and publicly available so people know about the impacts that are happening in their own communities.
Now, that said, Tom DiLiberto, how much of this database warns us about climate change, and how much is simply a matter of, for example, well, you know, there's more people living in more expensive homes on the coasts near the rising seas, et cetera. How much of this is just, you know, more people and more expensive real estate that's getting destroyed?
If this was a test question, multiple choice test question, it'd be D, all of the above. There are aspects of climate change involved in this. We know climate change is changing the frequency and intensity of certain sorts of extremes. And those sorts of extremes can lead to there being costlier events. We also know, as you noted, that we are building as humans in places that tend to be more prone to extremes. So you have this combination of climate change making certain extremes more likely and more strong and more intense, more things in the way to be destroyed, and you see an increase in the number of these billion-dollar disasters. But the key thing we're talking about here, no matter how you cut it, it's human activities. It's human decisions. These are human decisions why we're seeing this increase in disasters.
And decisions that we could make better thanks to information like this. Now, NBC News reports that this database, among others from climate scientists, is politically polarizing. As they describe it, House Republicans complained to NOAA's administrator last year in 2024 about the program, the billion-dollar database, describing it as presenting, quote, deceptive data. But this data set, it seems to me, unlike, say, you know, parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere going back hundreds of years, et cetera, this data seems pretty straightforward. Do you even understand, Tom, what they found to be deceptive about this data?
I think when they meant deceptive, they meant powerful. And I think that was probably the main reason. Everything is very clearly laid out. This has been multiple papers have been published on the methodology of how this is done in journals. It's been looked at through and through, even by NOAA last year when I was there. I was well aware of the complaints about this data set from those folks. And I saw the NOAA said, we'll look into it. And they found there being no issues with this methodology and no issues with the data set that came out. There were no corrections to this. But I think it's because it shows just how damaging these extremes can be. And then when you say, what should we do about it? Well, that's where it comes to there being issues, because in order to deal with these increasing extremes, we have to take action to help mitigate these the damages.
And there's the problem right there. Let's take no action. We don't want to hurt our friends in the fossil fuel industry. In one respect, well, I'm wildly thankful that Climate Central is now doing this, is continuing on this database. In another respect, I fear it sort of serves to kind of prove a point from many on the right that the private sector can do this work just fine. We don't need to spend taxpayer dollars on it. That's what Climate Central and other organizations are for. What's your response to that? And was that a concern when deciding to take on the hosting and updating of this database at Climate Central?
Oh, sure. The conversation's been had. And I think if you ask, you know, me or Adam, who also came from NOAA, like we never would have wanted to leave NOAA to begin with. And we would have loved to have said we would have loved to have this data set still being produced at NOAA. But NOAA made the decision to stop producing the data set. And it is simply too important of a data set to just have it disappear.
Yeah.
So in the end, we understood like all of those thoughts, but it's too important to not have anyone do it. But I think that anyone, we would love to see the government continue to produce reports like this because it's just them doing science and researching the problem.
I know there is also an effort to relaunch the climate.gov website, which you used to work on. It's now apparently being relaunched as climate.us. That's good news since climate.gov has been removed by the administration from the NOAA website, along with terabytes of information and data that was accessible there. How confident are you, Tom, that all of the NOAA data has been saved somehow, somewhere? Do you fear that any will have been lost in this stupid transition that we're all forced to go through here?
The amount of data that NOAA holds, it's the largest repository in the world of weather and climate data. And, you know, as someone who worked at NOAA for over a decade, almost 15 years before I was fired earlier this year, even I barely knew all of the different data sets. So it's very easy to imagine a situation where, yeah, certain data goes away and you don't even notice it until you need it. In terms of the large data sets, in terms of the really important ones that we know and use every day, I would believe that, yeah, there are efforts going around to make sure that that data is maintained. But the problem also comes, in order for those data sets to continue, there need to actually be weather observations. You need to have these weather models and climate models run. So it's important to maintain a continuous data set. Mm. So that's the fear too, is that while, yeah, they may not pull down the data, they may just stop collecting certain aspects of it. And then you have these large gaps. And if you don't have that data, you can't go back and make it up again.
As a climate scientist who, as you note, was at NOAA for about 15 years, you only recently left NOAA, the nation's premier science and weather agency, perhaps the world's premier science and weather agency. I don't know if it's still considered as such or not at this point, but why, in your opinion, your personal opinion, I guess, is the Trump administration doing what they're doing? Why are they cutting and gutting climate-related programs and personnel as you see it?
You know, I think they're not subtle in terms of the way they talk about climate research and climate scientists. And I think it's been clear that they oppose not only the research that's being done, but especially the conclusions to which one would obviously make based upon the very clear evidence that humans are causing climate change, and climate change is a major issue that we have to deal with. And this was certainly something that it was not just felt at NOAA, but it's been felt across the U.S. government in almost every aspect that climate is researched for the American people and really for the entire world. Mm-hmm. So they telegraphed this in terms of what they were going to do. And it was something that, you know, as someone who worked in climate for a long time, I knew was certainly a possibility once the election went the way it did. Mm.
So it's essentially the thinking here is, oh, if we do away with this data, if we do away with things like the $1 billion database, the disaster database, then, well, we don't know what's going on. Therefore, we can't act on it. We can't act on the climate change monster if we don't know about the monstrous data. Is that the general thinking?
And I think it's, you can't see it, you can't deal with it, or you can't understand it. But the thing is that with $1 billion disasters will continue to happen, whether we call them $1 billion disasters or not.
Right.
And people will still be experiencing these extremes. While they might shut off parts of NOAA, they can't shut off the atmosphere, and especially one that's being supercharged by climate change. So, and that's what's tough when you know that regardless of what any person says, the laws of physics are still going to be the laws of physics. We're still going to see increasing temperatures, increasing extremes, and sadly, we're going to continue to see people being impacted. And it's something that, you know, as someone who cares about this so much, is what drives me, is that we have to solve this. We have to fix this, which is why I'm incredibly grateful to being able to continue this work at Climate Central.
What was the can you sort of characterize your own experience at NOAA with the changing of the guard there earlier this year? And I suspect the mood probably set in last November, on election night. But can you sort of characterize the mood at NOAA, your own firing? How did that come about? What were you told when you were let go? And what is the mood like there now? I suspect you're in touch with at least some of the people who are still there.
Yeah, I'm in touch with a lot of my former colleagues and friends who still work there. And, you know, morale obviously is very low because, one, they're furloughed. And two, looking at the budgets that came out of the White House and the further attacks, the cuts are just the beginning of what we've seen. They want to get rid of almost the entire research wing of NOAA, which would drastically reduce the amount of science that the country does, but also lead to there being a whole host of horrible impacts, I think, for the American people now and especially in the future. Now, I was fired as part of the probationary employee firing. What that meant is I was hired less than two years when my probation period ended is when they fired me. and I, along with about 600 other people, were fired. And then a lot of other people were forced out. And
I thought you were there for 15 years.
I was a contractor at NOAA for 13 of those years, which is a very similar story. So when people heard about these probationary people getting fired, they thought that we were folks who were just out of college.
And
my story wasn't different. These are people who are experts in their field. They just happened to be make the slow process of becoming a federal employee for specific reasons. Like NOAA needed these people to do specific tasks, and they were all immediately gone. Now, I was fired with essentially, along with everyone else, a form letter. That had my name put into it that was the exact same as the other 600, 700 people who got it at the exact same time. That said that my talents were basically my skills were no longer needed at the agency, which was news to all of us as well as all of our supervisors.
Now, the right-wing manifesto known as Project 2025 in Chapter 21, they proposed breaking up NOAA, dismantling its inconvenient climate research, and basically privatizing the functions of the National Weather Service that is housed at NOAA in hopes of, among other things, I guess, forcing Americans to pay for their previously free weather forecast. Now, based on your experience at NOAA, does that accurately characterize what the administration seems to be doing right now? And if so, how far along is that plan as you see it in these these 9 short months since they've taken over again?
Well, they're certainly following a lot of the blueprint laid out in Project 2025, not just for NOAA, but the rest of the U.S. government. You know, I think they may have bitten off more than they can chew when it comes to completely privatizing weather forecasting, just because there is no company that can do what NOAA and the National Weather Service do. You're talking dozens and dozens of incredibly expensive radars and satellites and taking observations and running all of these weather models every single day. But even the idea on its face is just ridiculous. Would you need to have a platinum plan to get a tornado warning? Or is that how we're going to treat these sorts of things? It's, pennies on the dollar every single year, the American people get some of the world-leading forecasters of weather giving them a free forecast. And it's the very least that your taxes can pay for you is your right to get a free forecast and to know when danger's coming your way. This idea of privatizing it, we're putting a dollar sign on people's lives.
Yeah, well, I just wish you hadn't mentioned that whole idea about a platinum plan for tornadoes. I'm just going to cut that part out of the show so no one gets any ideas. For the future of the agency, should Americans at this point have any confidence that we will still receive reliable weather, if not necessarily climate data from NOAA and the National Weather Service?
Well, I could say this, the career federal employees who still work within the National Weather Service and NOAA are doing it not because, believe you me, it's not because of the paycheck, but they're doing it because it's a mission. Their mission is to provide this information in the best forecast possible so that people can make the best decisions to protect themselves, their loved ones, their communities. And they're going to try and do that no matter what, no matter how many hurdles are thrown in their way. And believe me, hurdles are being thrown in their way. And I think it's important that if we see any potential impacts to our ability to have these people issue those forecasts that we speak up. And we've seen that now where, because of the outrage at the number of people who left, the National Weather Service is now allowed to hire about 400 more forecasters, which again is ridiculous that you would have to go through that to begin with. A very obvious thing is to make sure you have enough people to forecast the weather 24/7. So I think it's important that it shows in those cases that if people complain enough and they're loud enough, there can be changes made. And the silly thing with it, at no point does anyone at NOAA, when looking at a weather forecast, think, oh, who'd this county vote for before giving them life-saving information? Yeah. We don't care.
Yeah.
No one cared. It's about giving the most important information to people. And I think they'll keep trying to do that as best they can.
Finally, Tom, we're all incredibly grateful and thankful for the folks at Climate Central who are continuing to do this work. I know there's a lot of folks like you who have moved over there from NOAA or the National Weather Service over to Climate Central and are trying to continue that work over there. Thank God for that. But this is a question I've asked a lot of folks working a lot of federal agencies, and I don't always like the answer I get back when I ask them. But after this is all over, if it ever is, do you think in this case we'll be able to put the NOAA and National Weather Service Humpty Dumpty back together again down the road, or is the damage being done permanent damage?
I'll start off my answer sad, but then hopefully end on a more positive note.
Smartly done.
And I'll say it's not like the lights were just turned off and we'll go back in and turn the lights back on again. It's much easier to tear something down than it is to build something up. But what this does give us the opportunity to do is build back in a way that is more prepared and agile for the challenges we know we are going to be dealing with for the next century. That may have been more difficult to do based upon just how the government can be sometimes, with how slow it can be to change. So I'd like to think of it, we have the opportunity to think about how we want the future NOAA to be, how we want the future government, weather, climate, environmental work to be done. And we have a chance to design that in a way that's better for everybody.
There you go. Smartly done. We have something optimistic here to look forward to. We can, well, build back better. Tom DiLiberto is the now the media director at climatecentral.org. You can find his work on the blue skies at T DiLiberto, if you can figure out how to spell it. We will, of course, link to all of that when we post today's show at bradblog.com. And by the way, you can stop by his website, tomdiliberto.com, to get a look at the NOAA cartoon series that Tom created called Teak and Tom. And Tom, I really hope that you're able to continue that somehow now that you're over at climatecentral.org. Really appreciate you joining us today on the broadcast, sir.
Thank you for having me.
We will look forward to doing that again in the future. He's great. He's fantastic.
Yeah, very good at communicating all of this.
Yes, and he is.
I'm just so glad that there is a place now for that data set to live until we get the chance to rebuild NOAA.
To build back better.
Yeah.
All right, quick break here and an update in the U.S. House gerrymandering wars with a rather stunning update I mentioned at the top of the hour. Just breaking out of an otherwise purple state where Democrats have suddenly announced a redistricting plan, a really fascinating one, in fact, for their U.S. House map in next year's midterm elections to flip as many as 3 U.S. House seats from red to blue in direct response to Trump and his desperate Republicans, their ongoing schemes to try and steal next year's elections through mid-decade partisan gerrymandering. That story is next. Plus, Desi Doyen and the Green News Report later, all still ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The broadcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Blue skies smiling at me, nothing but blue skies do I see.
Well, we'll see about that. Don't want to oversell it. Welcome nothing back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. All right, our story in the gerrymandering wars so far, very quickly. Donald Trump strong-armed Texas Governor Greg Abbott, not that he needed much strong-arming, into calling a special session of the Texas state legislature to gerrymander the state's already gerrymandered U.S. House maps in the middle of the decade in order to flip 5 currently Democratic seats to almost certainly Republican seats next year before the next year's critical 20, 26 midterm elections. Most of those seats are currently held by minority members, black or Hispanic, but with the U.S. Supreme Court in a terrible decision known as Rucho a few years back, essentially saying that drawing partisan redistricted maps is just fine by them. They have no problem with partisan gerrymandering. Well, with that, there's little to prevent Texas lawmakers from doing it, including a weeks-long attempt by Democratic lawmakers in the Lone Star State earlier this year to try and prevent a quorum by leaving the state. Nonetheless, Texas Republicans were able to pull it off in the Texas legislature. Five seats that had gone to Democrats and probably would again next year, now probably going to Republicans next year. In response, California, where U.S. House maps are drawn by an independent redistricting commission as opposed to a partisan legislature, well, there, lawmakers, Democratic lawmakers, called for a special statewide election coming up in just a few days now on November 4 that asks voters to vote yes on Prop 50, which would temporarily set aside the state's independent redistricting commission, the House maps made by them, in order to make it easier for Democrats to flip five currently red seats to blue here in the Golden State in order to counter what Texas did. Now, since then, Missouri Republicans have redrawn their U.S. House maps to do away with one of two remaining blue districts in the Show Me State. And this week, Republican state lawmakers in the very, very closely divided state of North Carolina voted to redraw their already gerrymandered U.S. House map again in hopes of making their House delegation even redder. The otherwise 50-50 state, which has a Democratic governor, for instance, and has for the last three elections, they currently have 10 Republican U.S. House seats to just four for the Democrats. That's how gerrymandered it already is. The new map that Republicans hope to put into place will likely make that an 11-3 House delegation next year. Also this week, Indiana Republicans have so far rejected Trump's strong-arming to redraw their already very red congressional map, but that could change. I sort of expect it to. And Democrats expect Florida Republicans there to attempt to redraw their state's congressional districts in early 2026. Republicans in Kansas and Nebraska have also explored gerrymandering their maps ahead of the midterms next year, though neither have yet taken formal steps to do so, which brings us to today. In the old Dominion state of Virginia, which has its own off-year state election already underway right now, Election Day is November 4, when a new governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, etc., will be elected along with the entirety of the state's House of Delegates. In Virginia, then, on Thursday, the New York Times is reporting, even while that election is underway, Democrats are planning the first step toward redrawing congressional maps in a pretty gutsy move that, if successful, could give their party two or three more seats next year in the U.S. House.
Okay.
The surprise development would make Virginia the second state after California, in which Democrats tried to counter the wave of Republican gerrymanders demanded by Donald Trump before the 2026 midterms. Democrats currently hold six of Virginia's 11 congressional seats. Redistricting could deliver two or even three additional seats for the Democrats, depending on how aggressive the map drawers choose to be. And, of course, if this somewhat complicated plan is successfully pulled off. Again, in Virginia, voters will get a say on this matter statewide. Quote, "We are coming back to address actions by the Trump administration," said Scott Surville, the majority leader of the Virginia State Senate, who confirmed these plans. Now, Virginia is one of few options that Democrats have to boost their chances to engineer more House seats for themselves next year, but it's a complicated scheme. Democrats control all facets of government in far fewer states than Republicans do. And many of those Democratic states like Colorado, New York, Oregon, Washington State have implemented redistricting reforms to prevent political gerrymandering. The governor of New York has said she wants to do that, but it won't be possible to do before the 2026 election. In Illinois and Maryland, those are Democratic states where redistricting is somewhat easier logistically. The governors there, however, have so far been noncommittal on doing that, though Democratic governors in both states have suggested that all options are still very much on the table, even if they, like me, hate all of this. But as Governor Pritzker, J.B. Pritzker, Democrat in Illinois, said on Tuesday, quote, "I'm not going to sit back and let Republican states create what he described as an unfair advantage." All right, so back to Virginia. Now, as in California, redrawing Virginia's congressional districts in the middle of the decade requires changing the state's constitution. To do that, majorities, it's a little bit more difficult in Virginia. In Virginia, majorities in consecutive sessions of the state legislature are needed once this year, and then again after January 15, when the newly elected delegates are seated following this year's November 4 election. So this has to be approved by both sessions consecutively, this new amendment. And what they're voting on is to put it on the ballot, because then it would have to pass a statewide referendum, which would or could go before voters early next year if all of this is pulled off. Got that?
That's a lot. But yeah, I think I have it.
Democrats would have to pass it in the state legislature
with the
twice.
Old, yes.
With both the current state legislature and the new one. They have to do that very quickly this year, and then early, again, do it early next year. If they can do that, then it would go before voters in a special election. So it is not an easy path, but there it is. That's the path if they can pull it off. Now, Democrats currently hold 51 out of 100 seats in Virginia's House of Delegates. So basically, a one-vote majority. What is it you always like to say, Desi Doyen? Elections matter.
Yes.
Every vote counts.
Every vote matters.
And so they've got basically a 51-49 advantage in the House of Delegates. They have a 21-19 advantage in the state Senate. So a little larger, but still a pretty slim majority. Virginia state senators do not face re-election until 2027. But all 100 seats in the House of Delegates in Virginia are up for election on November 4, when Democrats are expected to increase their margin. We will see about that, but that's the expectation. All of this coming just 12 days before that election. Now, under the existing map, Virginia was expected to have three competitive congressional races next year. No prospective maps have yet been drawn, according to two of the people involved in the plans, and it's not clear which Republican seats would actually be targeted if this plan goes forward. Now, former Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, she is the Democratic nominee for Virginia governor right now. She's said to be leading in the polls for the November 4 election. She has not been involved in planning this redistricting effort, apparently. She said back in August that she had, quote, no plans to commence a redistricting effort, though the state's rules do not require the governor's participation in constitutional amendment processes. And that's important because Virginia currently has a Republican governor, Glenn Youngkin, who is termed out this year. But the House of Delegates need to be in session in order to make any of this happen, and they normally are not in session right now. I think the governor is needed to bring them to a special session, so that's not going to happen. However, the process is actually beginning on Thursday afternoon when Democratic leaders in the General Assembly convene for a session that will begin on Monday. How is that possible? Well, Democrats can convene lawmakers to address the congressional maps right now on an administrative technicality.
Oh.
Yes. Governor Youngkin actually called a special session way back in May of 2024. But the Democratic legislators left it open. So that special session is actually still underway. That left the authority then to reconvene the chambers up to the Democratic Speaker of the House of Delegates and the Democratic Chair of the State Senate Rules Committee, both of which, thanks to the slimmest of majorities, especially in the House, happen to be Democrats. So that is how all of this is set to happen.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Kind of amazing, it seems to me.
Well, exploiting a loophole is something that the Republicans and Donald Trump are very
they
good
do
at.
All
so I
the
have
time.
No problem with Democrats using that exploitative loophole as
well. Yes, exactly. It's actually, in truth, it's kind of nice to see. All right, well, we're going to use the rules in our benefit for a change. Nice to see the Democrats actually doing that. Again, this is a long, difficult path to get through.
But it's worth trying.
But it seems possible, and I'm just enjoying very much seeing Democrats actually standing up to do this for themselves. Congressman Eugene Vindman, he is a Democrat in one of the swing districts in Virginia. He's expected to face a well-funded Republican challenger next year. He said, quote, "I'm proud that Democrats in Virginia are leading the charge to fight back against Trump's attempts to rig the midterms and are keeping their options open to ensure that we have fair elections next year." So we'll see if Democrats can pull this off. It's certainly gutsy, I would say, and that's not a word I usually use with Democrats, but it's gutsy, and as far as I can tell, it's a complete surprise until today, at least to me, and I cover this stuff pretty closely. I had not even heard whispers about this one, so that's pretty cool. But yes, it's also anything but a done deal. The measure will have to be passed twice this year, and once this year, once next year in the state legislature, which means Democrats will have to hold on to their House of Delegates majority, by the way, on November 4. And then voters will have to agree to amend the state constitution to do this. Now, Virginia voters, by a nearly 2-to-1 margin, approved an amendment back in 2020 that created the Independent Redistricting Commission in the first place in the state constitution. So they will have to vote to reverse that amendment, essentially, early next year in time to pull all of this off before primaries begin, et cetera. That's if Democrats get this passed twice in the state legislature before then. Many of the same state legislators who voted to put that amendment before the voters back in 2020 are now expected to ask Virginia voters to suspend it next year. As noted, I hate gerrymandering, but I also hate even more authoritarian power grabs. And so I'm delighted to see Democrats in Virginia stepping up to counter it. All right, quick break. Stay tuned. Green News Report is next. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is supporting you and the things that you care about. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. Right now, as much as ever. If you choose to support us, you can do it really easily, safely, and quickly via bradblog.com/donate. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Can you tell I'm kind of excited about that Virginia scheme?
Yeah,
Desiree,
it's a pretty smart move.
Oh well, we'll see how smart it is. But I'm happy to see them, you know, Democrats jumping in and even trying such a thing to push back. It's pretty clever. It's a lot of pieces to pull together, but yeah, I'm kind of excited about it. Anyway, well, that said, I know I'll get the excitement out of my system.
Okay.
Because, yes, Gotta get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
Poverty is more acute in the places with more climate hazards.
Groundbreaking report reveals powerful link between poverty and the climate crisis. The world is not on track to meet the Paris Climate Agreement's 2030 targets. Plus, the government is shut down, but not for the fossil fuel industry.
Well, how nice for them. All of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The government shutdown is now in its third week. Countless federal employees aren't being paid. Food stamps will run out soon. And there's no end in sight. But not to worry. President Trump is working day and night to build a ballroom. It's exactly what you voted for, coal miners in Pennsylvania.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, interesting study you've got to kick us off today. What do you got?
Well, first, a new United Nations report released in advance of the next Paris Climate Treaty Summit next month warns that nearly 900 million people around the world are increasingly exposed to the overlapping, intertwined threats of climate change, fossil fuel pollution, and poverty, from extreme heat and flooding to drought and toxic air pollution, often simultaneously in ways that amplify existing vulnerabilities. France 24 reports that for the first time, researchers with the United Nations Development Program have overlaid global climate hazard data with multidimensional poverty indicators, finding that poverty is, quote, deeply interlinked with planetary pressures and instability, especially in the poorest nations that lack the money and capacity to respond and adapt. The report warns that these burdens will intensify as global temperatures rise, as poor nations that did little to cause the climate crisis struggle with its impacts.
Mm-hmm.
A different analysis confirms that 10 years after the Paris Climate Agreement was signed by more than 190 nations.
10 years?
Yep. The world is off track and failing to act quickly enough to avoid the worst consequences of climate change. The State of Climate Action Report by the nonprofit Systems Change Lab found that while most countries are moving in the right direction, progress has stalled and is too slow and uneven to meet the 1.5 degrees Celsius target set out in the Paris Agreement. Despite encouraging signs like the global surge in renewable energy and electric vehicles, the world is still not on track to meet 2030 targets. The report's many recommendations include the rapid phase-out of all polluting coal plants and deforestation, and rapidly increasing climate financing from wealthy countries to developing nations.
How about rapidly phasing out the guy we have in the White House who wants the world to start using coal again?
That would certainly help. The analysis comes on the heels of a sobering report by the United Nations Weather Agency this week, announcing that levels of CO2 in the atmosphere saw the biggest annual increase on record in 2024, levels last seen 3 to 5 million years ago. In a press conference, Chief Science Officer Oksana Tarasova underscored how the planet responded the last time atmospheric CO2 was this high.
It was about 3 to 5 million years ago. The temperature was 2 to 3 degrees higher. The sea level was 10 to 20 meters higher.
For Americans, that means the last time CO2 was this high, the planet overall was 3 to 6 degrees Fahrenheit warmer, and sea levels were 30 to 60 feet higher than they are today. That is why scientists around the world are sounding the alarm.
Yeah, that's probably not a good sign.
Definitely not. And that is where the planet is headed if we don't reduce our emissions. Here in the U.S., the Trump administration is committed to making climate change much worse. The New York Times reports that even though the government is shut down, it is not shut down for fossil fuels or mining. Federal workers who issue permits for oil, gas, and mining operations are on the job, along with staffers working to repeal pollution standards and limits on greenhouse gas emissions. finally, a tiny bright spot of good news. The number of North Atlantic right whales ticked up slightly in 2024, according to researchers' latest estimate of the critically endangered species. The numbers released this week estimate that there were 384 right whales existing on the planet in 2024, an increase of 12 individuals over 2023, helped by increased regulation and oversight.
That's good, but only 12, eh?
Yep, it's not much, but scientists are cautiously optimistic.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Don't you know, don't you know, that we all gotta save the whales?
Yes.
Can't you see, can't you see, there's more than just you and me.
Yes, there is.
Yes.
And, you know, saving the whales, it was a simpler time, wasn't it? When I wish that's all we had to worry about was saving the whales at this point.
Yeah, those were kind of the good old days in a way, I guess.
They
because we didn't have quite as many battles to fight.
As many nightmares underway as we do. So anyway, we're saving the whales. We got that done at least today. All right, got to get out. Thanks again to our guest today, Tom DiLiberto of climatecentral.org. Thanks as well to our producer, Desi Doyen. Thank you, Desiree.
Yep.
And to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can always download them for free at bradblog.com or your favorite podcast site. But if you go to bradblog.com, not only will you see me writing about this, about today's story and linking to important material that you might want to click on to get more details, but you can also click on that donate button to help us stay on your public airwaves and, yes, save the whales. Or you can also go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves as long as we possibly can. Thank you in advance. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com, and you can find me on the social medias at the Brad Blog, especially Blue Sky. And as noted, you can also find Desi over there as well. Where?
At Green News Report.
There you go. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Don't you know? Don't you know? Don't you know that we all gotta save